Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast. This is episode 307 for September 22nd, 2016. My name is Daniel Bader, and I will be guiding this rickety canoe this week. And we have two other I shouldn't necessarily include myself, two very intelligent and enjoyable to listen to people. Andrew Martinick, all the way from the west coast of the United States. How are you, man?
Doing just fine, paddling on the left side of the rickety canoe.
Yes, and Jerry Hillenbrand, somewhere in the deep, I don't even know. I keep meaning to look up where West Virginia is, but I don't really care. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just wondering who the two intelligent and enjoyable people are.
Yeah, no, those are the ghosts that are not on the podcast, actually.
West Virginia is like in between two mountains.
Okay.
It's a mountain on top of a mountain, inside a mountain.
Is that a metaphor?
Where God can't see what happens.
That's a metaphor. And that's the first and last mention of that word today. This week we are talking about... Well, what we're not talking about in as much detail as we have in weeks past is the Note 7, but there are some updates there, and we'll get to that later in the show. But I wanted to obviously touch on the first and most important article, interview, both topic of the week, Google Allo. So, Andrew, this dropped at midnight on a Wednesday. Thanks, Google. And we've been playing with it for a couple of days now. So what's the verdict? We have some pluses, some minuses, some obvious to comes, but what's your initial impression of Google's smart messenger app?
Well, of course I got a weird view of it at the start because, like you said, it dropped at somewhere around 12:30 Eastern. That's 12:30 as an AM. I think that was to coincide with, apparently, it like launched in India first.
Yeah.
So it was like an India morning kind of thing, which was very interesting. But so that kind of took me out of my element a little bit because I was kind of scrambling to, you know, talking to Harish, one of our writers in India, you know, back and forth to try to see how it all works. But the interesting thing was that, you know, we saw the concept of Allo ahead of time at Google I/O, but we didn't actually see it working, and none of us got to use it ahead of time. So we're really bringing ourselves up to speed with like 95% of the situation with Allo. And I think because of that, people are surprised that it, but first of all, it's not finished, right? It still says it. I mean, it's like it's not a beta technically, right? But it's in like a this weird preview state, kind of.
Well, yeah. I mean, so we have to separate the actual app, the messaging platform and app, from the Google Assistant backend.
Sure.
And I think the app itself is largely finished. I mean, it's all no software is finished, but it's in a stable enough state.
Sure, whereas the service is not quite done.
It's in a preview edition, according to Google. And I think that's appropriate because it's not the most intelligent bot. Admittedly, it's one of the most intelligent bots out there, but just objectively, it's not that intelligent.
Sure. So I guess let me step back and kind of give the overarching look at this. In terms of chat, like just straight up individual chat, group chat, the app is fast. It's really clean. It's quick to launch. It's intuitive in terms of sending things back and forth. You can do all the normal stuff. You can attach photos and videos, you can record audio directly into chats, you can do stickers, all the emoji, all that kind of like table stakes chat stuff is all there. And then you have this second layer, which is the Google Assistant that you were mentioning, that's not quite done. And it's very weird because so you're having a one-on-one conversation with somebody or you're having a group conversation and there's this Google assistant just kind of sitting there waiting to butt in to your conversation. So you can explicitly mention it. You could type an at Google and it's set up in a way where after you type an at sign, it looks like it could potentially have other integrations that are called up that exact same way. And you could just type at Google and you could say, what's the weather like in such and such place on such and such day? And then everybody in the conversation sees you say that and then sees Google respond in line with everybody else. And there are these rich responses where you get just like a Google Now card, or you can get Google search results where you see a list of blue links, or you'll see links directly to articles with previews, and they load AMP web pages inside of Allo. So all the chat stuff is pretty normal, I think, and it works pretty well. But I don't know how you guys feel about this weird, you know, Google just injecting itself kind of in the middle of your chats.
Well, Jerry, I mean, have you had a chance to use this yet? Because I know you kind of came back after a couple of days off and everybody in the world was talking about Allo, and you're like, well, I mean, on the one hand, I think you've probably seen it a little bit more than we have over the months.
Yeah.
But on the other hand,
I got to play with it a little bit earlier.
Yeah. So, you know, is this the product that you thought it would be back when it was launched or announced in May?
Yeah. A lot of people seem disappointed, but I think this is exactly what we were told to expect. It's easy. It's like Andrew said, it's fast. And as a bonus, it has a, you know, I don't like to use the word smart or dumb when it comes to computer AI, but it has AI that can interject itself. Although it doesn't do that unless you tell it to. If you type in Android Central while you're talking to somebody, it may pop up with, you know, a thing for you to learn more about Android Central, but it doesn't broadcast that to the whole chat, you know, unless you actually call it. I'm not sure people wanted iMessage, and they can't, you can't have that unless, you know, Samsung has their own version and LG could make their own version, but you can't put that in Android because there's, you know, it's hardware dependent.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because do people actually want iMessage, or do they just want one really seamless chat experience that is accessible to all of their friends and family?
And, well, that, of course, that's what they want. And, you know, all the complaints aside, MMS aside, Allo is that, you know, I was texting a friend who has an old flip phone through Allo. Worked just fine. You know, yeah, he can't load.
So that's
any
the
apps.
Weird thing, though. It's not like Hangouts in that way, where you can legitimately have it just be your SMS client.
Right.
If you send, so it has this weird situation where it's tied to your phone number, but also your Google account, because it needs to sync back to Google, but it doesn't let you carry on conversations across devices. Like there's not a tablet app, and you can't have it installed on iOS and Android at the same time and have them sync or anything like that. So it's not a direct replacement for Hangouts in those ways, but it does have this weird thing where you can just type in a phone number or type in somebody's name that's associated with a phone number and send them what's ostensibly an SMS. But if they have an Android or iOS phone that's capable of installing Allo, then they get this weird thing where it's just like, here's a message waiting for you, and would you like to install Allo to reply?
Well, let's just call it what it is. They get an ad.
They do, and you force an ad on them.
Right.
So they get a message saying, why don't you join Allo? And then you can click a thing to download it and respond to a conversation that you're already part of.
Yeah, and I mean, this is not unusual to chat apps. Many of them have that feature where, especially when you start up, they'll ask you to spam essentially all of your friends with a link to the Play Store. Facebook Messenger, I think, is the biggest culprit when it comes to something like this. Not only does Facebook Messenger
just kind of tricks people into putting SMS in their app.
No, yes, you're right. But I'm talking about before that, back when Facebook Messenger was still building up its audience. This was pre-WhatsApp, before Facebook bought WhatsApp. They would try to get you to inadvertently send a text message to everybody in your contact list.
Yes.
And you would have to find the tiny little button at the bottom that says, no, please don't actually send a text message to 235 people. And the frustrating part was that every time you would install the app on a new phone or reinstall the app, it would ask you to do the same thing over and over again. Thankfully now, although it's still bad, but it's not quite as bad, it now tries to subversively take over your default Messenger app and integrate Facebook Messenger and SMS together. So to say that Allo is doing something unprecedented is not quite true. It's just that Google owns Allo and Google controls Google Play services, so it can integrate them more seamlessly than any other third-party developer.
Right.
So, I mean, is that bad? Is it something that we should be upset about, or is that just par for the course? Because as people who write about Android every day, we should be looking forward to Allo being a success. We shouldn't want it to fail.
Yeah, I don't think that it's a problem the way that they're doing that, but that is something that people are complaining about because they're used to this situation. Like Facebook Messenger, I think Facebook Messenger is a great example where it lets you send SMS and it will just do SMS back and forth. And Messenger is something you can do Messenger group messaging of things, and then you can do SMS. Just like Hangouts does, you can send SMS because it's a default app for SMS handling, and then you can send these group messages. So when they get to Allo, they need to understand that Allo is more like a WhatsApp or Kick or, you know, one of these tons of different messengers that are like this that are completely independent of SMS. And if you come at it from that angle, you start to be a little more okay with, you know, Allo as a chat platform. And I personally am okay with that. I don't like SMS. I don't want to deal with it. I hate that I have to deal with it in Hangouts now. It's just funky. The problem is that now this means that you don't have a secondary option within Allo. You can't make Allo your one chat app because, let's be honest, you're never going to have all of your contacts in one chat app. That's just not going to happen. And so people, like Jerry was mentioning with it being like iMessage, people want that route out. They want the ability to just send a plain SMS if they need to.
Right. But there are so many solutions already that try to master that integration. And Google already, I think, admitted with the fact that it's building Allo in the first place that Hangouts failed in that respect. You know, the integration of SMS into Hangouts was then largely deprecated and
absolutely
and replaced with Messenger, which is now pre-installed on the majority of Android phones. And I think it's interesting. It's interesting the bifurcation that we see between Hangouts as a cross-platform messaging solution that never really took off because nobody really thought of it as a mobile app. It was always a desktop Chrome app that was then shoehorned into the mobile ecosystem. And something like Allo, which is trying to recreate the success of WhatsApp. And WhatsApp has a billion users. It's one of the most successful chat apps ever. Then there are others like Line and WeChat that have integrated, that have made sort of in-app, in-messenger marketplaces a success. And then there are things like Kick, which have try to integrate bots and make an ecosystem and a real economy out of bots. And Allo attempts to do all of these things while keeping it very simple. So my question to you is, okay, so it's not an SMS app, but it uses your phone number as an identifier.
Which is like WhatsApp.
Just like WhatsApp. It has stickers that you can download from, you know, custom artisans that Google worked with. And it also has this really interesting bot. So where does it fall down? Like, where is the criticism coming from? Because from my perspective, Allo does everything really well. As Jerry alluded to, I actually agree with, you shouldn't call AI dumb, because it's not dumb. It's just, it's basic, it's limited, it's early. So where's the criticism coming from here, Jerry?
People assumed it would be Hangouts.
Yep. That's ding, 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 ding.
And it's the whole idea of Allo was to, let's not put our AI system into Hangouts, because Hangouts is so complicated that most people hate it. Whether you love it or not, people hate it. Allo is how you do it. It's, even if you don't want to use Allo, even if you hate the app, you think it's stupid, you need to install it anyway, because just pick any word on your phone that you're writing and highlight it, hit the overflow menu, and you can bring up the assistant that tells you about that word, takes a screenshot for you, and does stuff for you. I'm sure Google wants Allo to be successful. I mean, the next billion comes out of India, so that's why it was launched in India. Let's stop being selfish America as a continent thing here. But this is also gathering information for their artificial intelligence bank of monster room-sized computers, whatever they've got. So, and it's worth doing just for that. I don't know what else people wanted, Dan.
You know, I find it interesting, because back in 2013, when we were all sitting in the Google I/O keynote and Hangouts was revealed as this panacea of messaging solutions, it would be mobile, it would be in Chrome, it would be a desktop solution, it would sync across all of your devices, it would be on iOS, it would be fast and reliable and blah blah blah. At what point did people turn away from it? At what point did people say, oh, Hangouts is not the messaging solution for me, and it's actually a failure? Because I use it every day, and I love Hangouts, and I think it's reliable and it's basic, but it works. And I think Google nailed the fundamentals. So what's the problem there?
Well, I think as soon as people installed it and opened the settings, that was just enough. Hangouts, I agree. Hangouts is great for the three of us here, and probably, you know, a lot of the people that are listening. You're not afraid to have to change settings. You don't care. That's why they're there. But for most people, they buy a phone, they turn it on, they just want to chat to their friends.
I'll give you a second group of people that have stuck with Hangouts, and it's people that used to use Google Chat and Google Talk and have been talking with their friends and coworkers the last 6 years in Google Chat and Google Talk, and Hangouts was the next iteration of that. And that's the perfect example, is that these chat apps are sticky in that, you know, not only are they sticky because they're tough to move all of your friends somewhere else, but they're sticky from, you don't, like, it's tough to just give up on one and move to the other, and you always just want to have one.
See, I don't know about that, because I don't think it's a zero-sum game. You know, we see growth in chat apps to this day. We see growth in chat apps that I've never even heard of that somehow get to the top of the Play Store, probably by spamming, you know, contact lists, but still. And there are superior offerings to WhatsApp that abound, but it's the fact that it has that install base. I have WhatsApp. I have, you know, 400 people on WhatsApp, but I use it once a week because none of my friends use it. I grew up using ICQ, but all my friends all my US based friends tell me that they use MSN Messenger. Or Yahoo Messenger or AOL. It's about where your people are. Uh-huh. So, you know,
that's what I mean.
Has,
I don't I don't mean there's one chat app for the world or for a region. I mean, it's for certain people have chat apps that are specific to them and their group of friends and family. And they may have a couple because, you know, you have a, I don't know, you have a softball team that you play on and they use WhatsApp for their group chat, you know, to organize their games or something. But in the end, you come down to just one. And for a lot of people, that's iMessage, and their group of people have, you know, they have a group chat on iMessage that's been, you know, that has 10 people in it and it's been going for 4 years or something. But that's the reason why people don't want to jump around a lot. They would prefer one if they could have it. And that's kind of what the draw of Hangouts was, I think.
I would be willing to bet that if iMessage wasn't pre-installed and the messaging application on every iPhone sold, that Facebook Messenger would have a whole lot more people using it than iMessage.
That
can't be overstated. And Google could do that on, let's say, their coming Pixel phones. Allo could be a one-size-fits-all, does-everything app. And you wouldn't have to use a phone number to authenticate. You know, it would just use the account you signed in on the phone with. But then that would make that version of Allo different from all the other versions of Allo. Or Google would have to force manufacturers to bundle it in, which we don't like. The EU certainly doesn't like, and something that they're moving away from.
It's interesting. You know, you say that, but Duo, the video chat app that was launched last month, was pre-installed on my admittedly pre-production LG V20, and I can't imagine it's part of the CTS.
No, I'm sure it's not.
But it's interesting that LG decided to pre-install it, which I presume means that it's going to be on every V20 when it launches. So
I would hope so.
It gets into that tricky, you know, that tricky area of, as an OEM, do I promote even more of Google's first party apps, or do I try to get them to use our own? And I think an increasing number, LG included, but you know, HTC is a great example, and Motorola are deferring more and more to Google. And they're just making great hardware, and they're saying, "Okay, Google, you just take care of the rest." And I think we'll see that more and more. So I wouldn't be surprised if Allo, for a while, even lives alongside Hangouts as a pre-installed app on most Android phones.
I think, to me, that's a plus. But having Google force manufacturers to do it, I don't like. I think in the long run, it's smart to not use your own email client or your own calendar or your own SMS app. And I'm looking right at you, Samsung, because that's how you get every user, all 2 billion Android users, to use the same apps.
Okay, so we've dug a lot into Allo as a chat app, but let's talk a little bit about the assistant, because I think that's really interesting. So
yeah.
when you start with Allo, you see a number of things right away. You see that when you get a notification, it's a rich notification on any Android phone that supports such things. Lollipop and above will provide the richest notifications, Marshmallow more so, and then Nougat even more so. So you have a really nice experience, but there's no inline replies. Instead,
no,
Google actually suggests
–
yeah, right. Google actually suggests these smart replies instead. So, Andrew, I have seen you rail both in our internal Slack channel and on Allo itself against this decision. Why the heck did Google do this?
I can't tell if it's overconfidence about how good they think smart replies are, or if it's just something that they want to try to promote smart replies no matter how good they think they are. But it's so weird that they have this ability to have a rich notification and let you tap on it and type and reply directly into the notification. And they don't even, it's not that they give you the smart reply choice and then hit another button in the notifications to type. your only options are to dismiss a notification, tap it to enter the whole app, or send one of two smart replies, which, by the way, you're sending a smart reply to what is most likely a clipped message that you can't read the entirety of, because if the message that came to you is more than a handful of words long, it's going to...
Stop. Put your finger at the bottom of the notification and gently pull down. You can not only read the message, it scrolls. You can read the entire conversation.
Mine have truncated into an ellipses at the end.
Huh.
I can't scroll inside of the notification. Maybe that's a NuGet thing.
Yeah, it would be only a NuGet thing.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm using it on a Galaxy S7.
And then again, maybe this version doesn't do that.
So
before I open my big mouth.
Anyway, so no matter what, even if you can on NuGet, that makes sense that you can scroll through the whole notification. Why are you letting me read, like, that makes it even worse. You're letting me read four or five sentences, perhaps, and the two responses I can give are yeah and not really.
Or even worse, it's like ha-ha and aw.
See.
These smart replies, even in the app where you get these, so that's a little outlined clear button with words in it, and you know they're ostensibly contextual to what has been written to you and yada yada. You can scroll side to side on them and you get what, 2, 3, 4 potential responses to be able to give back, and they've just been bad for me. A lot of people have said that they're really awesome and those are the kind of replies that they've would have meant to say, but they, for me, they're not only not like what I would type, but they're not really contextual. They're super generic, like ha-ha or yeah or not really or okay. They're really weird, generic things that just, they don't sound natural. They do sound like a bot is replying.
Well, they're quick replies. They're presented differently, but you know, most messaging apps have had access to some sort of quick reply feature.
I mean, most people's keyboards do this. They give you the suggested words, right?
Yeah.
Even if you haven't typed.
I for one like it. If I want to say anything more than okay or K or no or yes, I want to open the app and type something anyway. They work for me, but you know, if they don't work for you, it's a shame that there's not an alternative. But then you get into a bunch of settings. Do you want to enable the quick reply feature? Notice that this may blah, 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 something other. And I think that that's the biggest thing they want to stay away from, is making people read and make a choice.
Here's my question, actually. I'm going to do this live while I let Daniel reply, but I'm going to see if I can tell the Google Assistant that I don't want smart replies.
And that's, I mean, what is interesting to me is that this will take a little while to find its footing, because I think people will overemphasize the use of these smart replies, as they often do with new features in messaging apps. And then eventually they'll realize that they work occasionally, and then occasionally they don't. And they're to some extent useful, because many times the answer is appropriate. And we should emphasize that the answers are actually shown in the app itself, as opposed to just in the notification shade. So if you're in a conversation, the smart replies are there as well. Again, they're not always appropriate and they're not always good, and they make for some hilarious sort of proto-robotic back and forth conversation, but they're there. So the next question is, where does it go from here, right? Google is sucking up all this data. And we heard that they rolled back a little bit on a privacy policy that they announced back in May, where they wouldn't store in perpetuity all of the data from your chats. They would only do it for a certain time before they would wipe it. Now you explicitly have to end a chat for Google to remove that chat data from its servers. But once it gets all of this stuff and it's able to aggregate it all and use its machine learning algorithms to figure out the best smart replies, then yeah, I mean, people could potentially have full-on conversations with no actual words being typed.
I want to touch that security thing for just a second.
Go.
Because 9 out of 10 people I've seen complaining about it all use iMessage with iCloud backup, which is exactly the same thing. It's stored encrypted. Apple has a decryption key on the iCloud account. You can opt out by not backing your iMessage stuff up to iCloud, and it doesn't get stored or encrypted. On Allo, you can opt out by using incognito mode, and it doesn't get stored. I said it doesn't get encrypted. I messed up. It doesn't get stored on iMessage if you opt out of iCloud backup. Does the same thing if you use incognito mode. It's encrypted both ways. It only stays on your phone until you close the window, and what's on your phone is encrypted underneath the encryption required to start your phone. They're identical.
So that's interesting, because incognito mode is end-to-end encrypted. If you start one of those chats, it means Google has not and will never have access to that chat data. It goes from one phone over Google servers, fully encrypted, and is then decrypted on the other person's phone. With a regular chat, though, it's still encrypted. It stays on Google servers. And the major concern there is that if law enforcement does want access to it, it can submit a court order to obtain that data.
Right. Google can get in, just like BBM or iCloud iMessaging. These companies got to cover their behind. Look how difficult Apple had a time, you know, because iCloud backup wasn't available. Look what they had to go through just to show that, look, we can't do this any foreseeable way that we want to do it. You'll have to find someone else to actually break in. And that was costly. It was good PR, but it was costly. And companies don't want to go through that. They have to make things available when they have to be available.
Okay, so if everybody's sort of getting tired of the Allo chat, let's sum it up a little bit. I think Allo is largely a great 1.0. It performs its function. It's got some cute stickers, and it may, as Jerry intimated, not entirely be intended for Western markets. It is heavily optimized right now for India. And I think that's because there is an opportunity there. It's not even available for me yet in Canada. So Google is really taking its time rolling this out. And from the assistant side, it's impressive, but it's basically like having Google Now in a chat app. That's how I feel. So it has a lot of potential, but it's not quite at the point where I would go out of my way to use it. Andrew, is that something that you can, you know, are you and I on the same page there?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much there. I'm very happy with, like I said at the start, I'm very happy with the speed and the general chat components in terms of having group messages, you know, how fast it is to get notifications. And I think that part is good. And I understand that why people are frustrated that, like, if you were to say that Allo was coming out without all of the, you know, quote unquote smart features, it would be very, very boring. But that is the part that's really well executed, and that all works. I don't really care that it doesn't have the SMS integration. We saw how horrible that went trying to do mixed conversations with SMS and Hangouts. And yes, the smart replies are annoying, but you don't have to use the smart replies, as Jerry said, walking me off the ledge. I get that. I think that right now the Google Assistant is very much early. like I said, I was going to try to tell it to turn things off. It doesn't know anything about the settings in the app. It doesn't know how to handle that. And for the most part, the only reason why Google Assistant is annoying to me or disappointing to me is that I know that it doesn't have as much capability as when I'm on my home screen and I swipe over and get Google Now. So that's kind of annoying. And they're separate is the only real issue for me. Yes, Jerry?
They need to be. It's a good thing they're separate because Google Now is your personal information only displayed to you. Google Assistant is your personal information for some things, but it's shared information with a lot of the other stuff. You don't want Google Assistant sharing, you know, what seat you're going to be on the plane next week.
Oh, well, I mean, why not, though? I mean, the whole thing is that, like you said, Google Assistant just doesn't just come into your group chats and start adding things. If I am in a group chat with three other people that I'm flying with and I say, show me my flight details, I think that there's a reasonable expectation that Google Assistant will say, here's your flight details, and everybody in the chat can see that.
You know, I'm sure that's a possibility, and I agree that'd be a cool feature. But with AI, if you just let it do its thing, I mean, ask Microsoft how that went with their racist Nazi bot.
Tay-Tay.
Yeah. You can't, if you don't tread lightly, it's worse than keeping a throttle on it.
My problem is that, so I'll go even further. There's just a complete firewall there where I say, tell me about the weather. And it's like, oh, I have no idea where you are because you haven't told me that it's okay to know where you are, even though it's tied to the same Google account that I've given it access to my location for the past 5 years. And I go to Google Assistant, even in our, you know, private, whatever, chat directly to Google Assistant. And I say, remind me to do something at 3 o'clock today. And it's completely separate from the reminders in Google Calendar and Google Now.
Yeah.
And it's like that, it's those kinds of lacks of integration and lack of understanding about where it fits in the rest of the Google ecosystem. The assistant AI doesn't know where it fits in the Google ecosystem. That's very frustrating to me.
Well,
now, I don't have to use it, and it doesn't really have to get in. Like I said, I understand that it's not necessary, and the chat portions of the app are really good. But the problem is the AI and the smart replies and things like are the selling feature that make it, you know, worth considering and worth trying to, you know, badger all my friends into using Allo for. Because if all I'm going to use is just the basic chat functions, it's not worth trying to fight everybody to get them to come over to Allo. Like, I need a sales, Allo has to sell me and sell all my friends on why we should use it.
So here's the privacy issue that I foresee. So you remove that firewall and you give Assistant access to your personal Google account, which is right now consolidated through Google Now and Google Now and Tap and or whatever name they're morphing into. And then you have this potential of your friends' Google accounts sucking up that information. And, you know, given that AI is in its nascent stage right now, we have this potential of sharing and then mixing too much of that personal information.
Right.
And I don't want, say, my friend to have the ability to set a group reminder for a wake-up call at 4:30 in the morning and then accidentally have Google Now set my phone to wake me up at 4:30 in the morning.
Well, right? I don't think that we should... I mean, I know that the AI is not perfect, but that is a very, like, black and white on-off thing. So if somebody in a group chat says, set a wake-up call for 5 a.m., you should just get the little button at the bottom like you do in every other Google Assistant prompt that says, do you want to set this or do you not want to set this? And the default is not. I mean, these, like, that's a very simple example of Google knows how to do that. Google can very much say, there's a group chat, it does this thing, you approve, deny.
You're right. And I'm not suggesting that it's impossible for Google to successfully bifurcate public and private, and not have one bleed over into the other. And I agree that there must have been examples, you know, within the beta test of Google trying to make that happen. I mean, the fact mm-hmm. that you can't even set a reminder for yourself from Allo and have it sync up with your Google Now reminders or your Google Calendar reminders means that firewall is there for a reason right now. And I'm taking it for granted that it's there because Google thinks that it's either safer or faster or better for that firewall to be there.
We're all missing the point.
Then what's the point?
You can use Allo without a Google account. If it syncs to your Google account, that feature goes away.
Well, it doesn't let me now not use a Google account. It's required as part of the app setup. I just set it up on my Galaxy S7 like an hour ago.
Interesting. I know that's what they tell us, is that you don't need a Google account.
I'm in my Allo. So yeah, that's actually interesting. So you do have the option to set it up. You have to set up a Google account if you're connected to Google. But now I went into my settings and I disconnected my Google account.
And you just get the messaging without the Google Assistant.
Correct. And it still works. So Google Assistant goes away. Oh, no, it's still there.
Yeah.
It's not still there.
Uh-huh. No, it doesn't let you talk to it.
Yeah.
See, this is confusing.
So, like I'm saying, it's part of the setup experience that it connects to your Google account. I'm totally, like, I think that it's awesome that you can hit disconnect and it will no longer, because you're right, it doesn't sync your chat. Like, it syncs the chats, but it doesn't sync the history or the state between devices or anything like that.
And that's,
I'm glad that you can tie it to your phone number and have that happen and you can disconnect the Google account. But
a billion iPhone users are glad that don't have a Google account are really glad too. You know, not that they'll ever install it and use it, but they could without a Google account.
Right. So what this is saying is Google Assistant will work without a Google account, but you won't obviously be able to access any of that personal information. So you won't get your calendar. You won't get your your contacts. You won't get
it doesn't
stuff
exist.
That's exactly. So
it
that's a good
anything.
Thing.
Yeah.
But you're right, Jerry. That's actually a good point. You don't need it, and Google designed this so that it can live independently from a Google account.
And you can still set a reminder or look at pictures of cats online through the assistant.
Yeah, I totally I like the fact that that exists, and I have no problem with this whole tied to your phone number thing. I don't have a problem with Duo being tied to a phone number either. I think that that's the way they want to do this, and it enables to do this thing where they can allow you to remove the Google account from the situation. I totally get that. But when I do have it connected to my Google account, which, by the way, is on by default, I want more than, like, I want it to be integrated with other things. I want to be able to set a reminder for myself when it's tied to my Google account and have that reminder be brought to me on other devices and be part of my calendar. I want, you know, I want to be able to have it search my Gmail and find something like when it finds my flights and stuff like that. I want that explicitly.
Right. And I don't think there's any reason that can't happen if you know, if you're signed in with Google on your phone, which is a big incentive to get people to sign in with Google on their iPhones.
Sure.
So I'm not going to say that's not in the works.
Well, that's kind of the whole point, is that Google Assistant is this back end thing that can be updated on Google's end.
Right.
It doesn't require a front end update on the app. And we see this in Google Now all the time. It just has new features and think, you know, cards look different and they have new bits of information and they're smarter about knowing where you are and what you want without you having to update anything or do anything. Now, will people hold on and use Allo long enough to realize all of these new things? I mean, I don't know. There's obviously a slow ramp up period to, you know, getting a group message. Like, I have not told any of my friends or family to try to install Allo yet because I can only get people. And this is the thing, you know, you can only get people to switch with you to different chat programs, you know, with a certain frequency. You know, do I want to spend one of those moves on Allo yet? I'm not going to do that just yet.
It's like you have a call a friend, you have a whatever the other ones were.
Yeah, the ask the audience.
Ask the audience. So, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying. And it's interesting, too, that this is coming out 2 weeks before what we think is going to be the launch of the Pixel phones, right?
Come on, Google, we know clearly, it is. Stop.
Well, okay, yes, of course we know. But on, when was it? On Monday or Tuesday of this week, Google sent invitations to its Made by Google event, which is presumably where they're going to announce that they have taken ownership over, you know, its phones. We know that they're going to be made by HTC, but that the software will be a little bit more custom than what we're used to on a Nexus device.
HTC is the manufacturer, not a partner.
Right.
Yeah, is the big difference.
That's the distinction.
Foxconn.
Right, it's the ODM, I guess.
Right.
So Allo is presumably going to have a presence there. And I would guess that we're going to hear a lot more about Assistant as a platform and ecosystem at this event because we're expecting the release date and pricing for Google Home, which is the Amazon Echo competitor that we've been looking forward to also since May. So yeah, this is not the last we're going to hear of it. And we're going to take a quick break and we're going to, you know, take a breath and let hear a little bit about our sponsor. But when we're back, we will continue this conversation and we'll talk a little bit about the Note 7 recall, where it's at, and a little bit more. So we'll be right back. This week's episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Harry's. We've mentioned Harry's before, and we're super thankful that they keep coming back week after week. Harry's makes great razors for less. Specifically, they charge $2 per blade compared to the $4 or more you'll pay for those other brands at the drugstore. Harry's 5-blade razors are awesome, and they include a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for those hard-to-reach places, a lubricating strip, and a textured handle for when it gets wet. I've been using Harry's, and I love it. It's really nice to finally have soft skin after a shave, and there's no irritation. 5 blades, yeah, they actually work. Harry's was founded by two friends who wanted to offer a great shave at a fair price. They even went to Germany and bought the factory that they had hired to make the blades because they liked them so much. That's why Harry's can produce high-quality razors themselves and sell them online for half the price of the drugstore brands. Quality is always 100% guaranteed, and if you don't love your shave, Harry's will refund you. So how do you get started? How do you try Harry's? Well, if you want to and you are listening to this podcast, you can get a great deal. All you have to do is go to harrys.com and you can get a starter set for just $15. That includes 3 precision-engineered 5-blade cartridges, moisturizing shave cream, a weighted razor handle of your choice, and a travel cover, all for $15. And for limited time only, there's another special offer for fans of the show. But what do you do to get that? Well, all you do is you go to harrys.com and at checkout, you enter the code AC. That's harrys.com and enter the code AC at checkout to redeem your deal. Okay, back to the show. So, guys, we can't have a podcast today without talking a little bit about the Note 7.
Nope. From here on out, every single podcast, Note 7, right?
A little bit. I don't want to say that's true, but it kind of is. So today, I got the date wrong, actually, earlier. So I apologize for that. But Oh, no, I didn't. Never mind. September 22nd.
You're good.
I'm good. Today is the rollout of a software update for all Note 7s in North America. That's new and old, pre and post recall. And it's a very minor change, but it's significant for the brand, the Samsung brand and the Note brand. And it's the changing of the battery icon from white to green. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about why Samsung is doing this.
So the interesting thing, we first heard about this, as has been the case with the whole recall. You hear about something that's happening in another region, and then it happens in our, you know, in your home region, Canada, the US, Europe have been the big ones that have been trendsetters, I guess. So what they're going to do with this software update is it's going to be like an extra annoying software update to get you to install it, in terms of reminding you like every 3 hours and putting up a big message saying you need to install it, yada, yada. So the whole idea is get this on as many Note 7s as possible, because once it is rolled out, they can start to promote the fact that the only safe Note 7s with quotes are ones that have a green battery icon in the status bar. And when you go to reboot on that splash page has a green battery icon also, because it turns out that their first attempt at this, which was to put a black square on the IMEI sticker on the bottom of the box, was a very bad idea, because it's really easy to just make black square stickers and start putting them on boxes and selling them as safe phones, which, now that you think about it, was a really dumb idea.
Well, yeah. Well, they stopped doing that. So
right. So that's why they're pushing this software
but
so
let's
much.
Not fool ourselves. For unlocked phones outside of North America, it's just as easy to put a green battery icon on.
Of course. It's just a lot harder to do at scale than printing off a giant piece of vinyl and cutting it into little squares and sticking it on a box.
I get that, but the people who are going to want to sell bad phones to turn a quick buck are the same people that will go to XDA and see how to change the battery icon.
Right. And there's always, and this is why we have recommended from the start that if you're ever in doubt, you look at the IMEI number, which again, like you said, they can change the display of the IMEI number if they really want to, and you can check it against Samsung's database. But again, it's a lot more time intensive, especially at scale, to change the display of the IMEI number or change the battery icon than it is to put a little sticker on the bottom of the box. And so that's why they pushed out the software update. And now I wish that the software update was even more aggressive in telling people that they need to know seriously this time, please, for once and for all, please send in your Note 7. But Samsung can only do so much without really pissing people off further.
I think that they should just check the actual device ID, the serial number on the processor. And if it's not a good one, tell you in 2 hours, your phone's done forever. Bye. Sorry. Tough.
So,
yeah, they very well could. But of course, like I said, it's that could introduce even more frustration with people when Samsung already has a lot of frustration applied to their customers the last 3 weeks.
So, yeah, I mean, I got a really interesting opportunity yesterday to talk to Paul Brennan, who's the COO of Samsung Canada. He's Tim Baxter's counterpart, who went in front of a camera last week and issued a mea culpa about the Note 7 recall to the U.S. market. And Brennan reiterated a lot of what Baxter said. He noted that, you know, he thinks Samsung's done a great job. Obviously, he thinks that the consumers are largely behind him and his company. Obviously, I mean, this he was applying this mainly to Canada, but he did say that he's heard similar things in the U.S. But what he did say was that, you know, this was done as a way to incentivize the holdouts, the people who haven't returned their notes, to do so voluntarily. And if they get the right percentage of returns, then this will be the end. They'll get as many back as possible and they'll move on. But And just to note, once you install this update, if you're using an older phone, you're going to get a warning to telling you to recall to send back the phone to Samsung every time you restart and every time you boot up. So you shut down and you boot up. That's significant and potentially quite annoying, but it may not incentivize everybody to get rid of their phone. The next step, and something that Brendan said he will do if necessary, is a kill switch. He'll work with the GSM Association to essentially ban the IMEIs of all recalled Note 7s on all North American carriers. So,
which, by the way, is what you called for 2 weeks ago.
It is what I called for, and I think it's the right thing to do if they are taking it seriously. But it's a very different story in Canada and the U.S. So Canada, they had 22,000 recalled phones. They already have 15,000 of them back, and they're only trying to get a number like 6,700 remaining or something. In the U.S., it's very different. There were over 1 million recalled. And I think you have the number. I'm not sure in front of me, but it's significantly less than that. It's only about 40% or 30.
Yeah, it was like 20% this time last week. But now that we have this new stock of phones that came in, presumably it's higher. But I still would be surprised if it was over 50%.
And the other 50%, it's your fault. The phone's going to be banned on a plane for 6 months. It's your fault. I hope you're proud.
So that's the other thing. A lot of people, and Jerry, you've talked about this many times, a lot of people aren't taking this recall very seriously. Will a green battery icon, you know, as compared to a white battery icon, really make a big difference?
No,
it's not going. This is not an aspirational change. It's not going to give you any more functionality. This is a platitude so that people can essentially tell the difference between good and bad. And that's really all that Samsung's doing. But the software update warning you that it's not going to, it wants you to recall the phone and that it's not going to work properly, that's not really going to do anything. It's just more right. of an annoyance than anything else.
Right. I mean, Samsung had to do something because we wanted them to do something. But what could they actually do? I mean, other than remotely turn them all off or go to each and every person's house and take it away, there's not much they can do. It's up to
That's
us.
That's why they have to do the remote kill at some point.
Well,
because
I hope they do. But
think about it: 2 or 3 weeks down the road here, where let's just take a shot in the dark. 80% of the phones have been returned in the U.S. You're still talking about 200,000 Note 7s still out in the world that were recalled and have not been replaced or exchanged. That's 200,000. That's a huge number of phones, and that's still the number where you're going to see stories about it exploding, and you know the CPSC is not going to be happy that there are still 20% of the recalled phones out there. And now we're talking about 6 weeks on from the first signs of this, or Samsung first acknowledging it, and we're still going to be looking at 20% of the sold phones out there, and they're still going to have all these issues with airlines that don't want to let you turn the phone on. I mean, the green battery icon is good for those sorts of situations where you can say, look, Samsung said that if it has a green battery icon, it's fine, and you can have a little bit of an argument there then why you should be able to use it. But they can still say no because they can point to the CPSC saying that it's still recalled.
Exactly. And I think from Samsung's perspective, they've hit all of the marks. They've taken what the CPSC and all the other health bodies and regulators have wanted from this recall. Because remember, these regulators are overseeing dozens of recalls. They're not just overseeing this one thing. So Samsung had to hit a checklist, and it had to hit a bunch of milestones, and it's done this. So, you know, from what I was talking to Paul Brennan about, he was saying they worked with Health Canada to get this recall issued as quickly as possible. So the stop sell happened September 2nd. The form to allow people to return their phones was launched on September 6th, which was the Tuesday after the long weekend, the Labor Day weekend. And then the official recall happened a week later on September 13th. The CPSC recall was 2 days after that. It was September 15th. But for all intents and purposes, Samsung had recalled this phone a week and a half earlier.
Yeah.
It's just that they needed to work with the regulators to make it official.
And they needed to have phones available to replace. I mean, the issue in the U.S. was that it was very surprising to me that 170,000 people had even returned their Note 7, because if you wanted a replacement, there weren't any available. So that was the big issue, that yes, they officially had, you know, on their end, you know, CPSC aside in the U.S., had gone out of their way to have all that stuff done, and you had the IMEI checker, and they said explicitly you can go back to the carrier. But if you were somebody that wanted a phone replacement, then for direct swap for a Note 7, which you were entitled to based on what they said, you couldn't do it until this week. Really, yeah. for all practical purposes, unless you lived in a major metro area with lots of access to multiple stores where you could find one.
That's a crutch, dude. I don't care. I don't care if you have to go.
A crutch for what?
You sound like somebody who's just refusing to turn it in. I'm waiting for a replacement. That's a good way to hurt yourself and other people. I don't care.
Oh, no, I can.
If you have to go without a phone for a month.
We're completely in agreement,
yeah,
Jerry.
Okay.
I'm telling you that Samsung cannot use that as an excuse.
Oh, okay.
Samsung cannot say, well, we started the recall on September 6th. Well, it's like BS, because you didn't have phones available for people to replace.
But.
And you said that you would. And so unless you said to every carrier and every retail store, no matter what the person does, you have to take the phone from them, which they didn't say. They told people that they would be able to get a replacement phone, and there were not replacement phones available. So I'm saying that Samsung could not say, they can't say, oh, we were way ahead of the curve. No, if you didn't have a phone sitting on every single shelf in every carrier store ready to ship to everybody's house, then you can't say that the recall, you were ahead of it.
I think they can. I think they had their priorities exactly right. Why wait for the U.S. and Canadian government to do their paperwork? Let's tell people right now, this is a safety issue. And yeah, we want people to buy our phones, like our phones, and continue to buy our phones. That's why we make what we think are the best phones. But it's not worth getting hurt for. Get rid of it. We'll have programs in place. For now, you can get another phone or do something, whatever. Just shut it off right now and get rid of it. Was absolutely right call.
I get that entirely. There is no reason why they didn't have any reason to wait any longer. But what I'm saying is they did not say that. At the first week and a half was, we're investigating reports. And it's like, what? You knew. Like, they had enough data to know to tell people way more sternly or push these updates way earlier than they did.
Well,
now,
so,
of course, you can always say in hindsight that they could have done it sooner. But what I'm saying is, if you didn't have a stock of phones ready to replace, then anything you say is kind of like whatever, because you know that people are just going to hold on to their phones. They don't want to get rid of their phones.
So here's the other thing too. Samsung, if we are to believe the Bloomberg report that was issued earlier this week, knew about these batteries. I think I do to some extent. So there was a report from Bloomberg that said Samsung knew that there were problems with the battery in the Note 7 back in August, before the phone actually shipped, and that it was hoping that this would blow over, that there would be maybe one or two incidents and it wouldn't be a big deal, and that they would be able to move on from this. And once they said that they were investigating the issue back, I think it was August 31st, September 1st, right before the stop sell, because remember, the stop sell came out of Korea. And it was the night of September 1st, yeah. And we heard about it the morning of September 2nd. So they were investigating that. And I think what was happening was that they were taking a few days to see whether this was as broad and as widespread as they were hoping it wasn't. As you know, they took too long to admit that there was a problem. But the other part of it is that if they had recalled the phone, from a business perspective, playing devil's advocate, if they'd recalled the phone and there were no systematic problems with the batteries, then they would have lost how many, you know, untold billions of dollars. They're going to do that anyway.
And 27 people wouldn't have been physically injured.
Yeah. And so that's the part. That's the part that they need to admit, and it's the part that they won't admit.
If Bloomberg is right, and I'm not saying they are or they aren't. I don't know what to think there. But if they're right, Samsung, I hope you go out of business. I hope one of those people that got hurt owns everything you own, including the division that makes tanks, because you deserve it if you let people get hurt and you knew.
So, I mean, that's the other thing too. So we wrote a roundtable today about whether this will have a long-term impact on Samsung's business. And I think most responses boil down to yes in the short term, but long-term Samsung's too big for this to have a hugely negative effect.
Yep. It's outside of the people that are listening to this podcast, people don't worry about history when they go buy something. If they see what they like and it works well, that's what they buy.
And it's interesting. You actually refer to a fairly famous recall, Jerry, in your blurb, the Toyota recall of 2009.
Yeah, I was involved in that, and it was a mess.
It was a mess, and that was one of many automotive recalls that have happened in the last 10 or so years. And what you think at the time is that this is gonna kill them. Like, Toyota's done, Nissan's done, but somehow they rebound and they move on and they keep iterating and making and releasing new vehicles. And this is going to be the same thing. The Galaxy Note 7 is going to have a green battery icon for a year, and then the Note 8 will not. And some people will make fun of it, and some people will say, I'm not buying one until I know that the battery's safe. And then the Note 9, nobody will say that, and it'll just be distant history.
And hopefully, the batteries in all the future Samsung phones are going to have a little bit of extra attention paid to them. And those random acts where they do fail maybe will be fewer because of it.
And I think that the only issue that they have to deal with is we know that Samsung phone or iPhone or LG phone or whatever, phone batteries do fail and phone explosions and fires do happen. And so the next time that happens with a Samsung phone, at the same very, very small rate that it happens in all batteries in these phones, how well Samsung responds to that and how much, you know, the kind of breaking news, oh my gosh, another Samsung phone caught on fire, you know, happens is going to, you know, those little things are going to matter. But in the aggregate, it's going to be such a small number of people, like Jerry said, that are going to intensely care enough to, you know, make that part of their buying decision when the Galaxy S8 comes out or Note 8. Or, I mean, see, the thing is, this should play into your, I mean, or this shouldn't play into your decision is the whole thing. I mean, of course, people aren't entirely rational and they don't think in those terms of, well, even a new Note 7, let alone a Galaxy S8, is expectedly going to have the same battery failure rate as any other high-end phone with a high-end battery.
Batteries, this is kind of a good thing, and I don't say that lightly. And if you were hurt or you had property damage from this, I'm not making light of your situation at all. But this was a good thing. A lot of people didn't know just how dangerous the batteries in these phones or vaporizers or outdoor sprinkler equipment, anything that uses lithium batteries, are inherently more dangerous.
I mean, and really quickly, even more importantly, these really cheap external batteries that a lot of people buy that are sitting in a blister pack at 7-Eleven that are, you know, a 10,000 milliamp hour battery that is not in any way held to the same quality standards of the one that's a third of the size in the Note 7.
Right.
I mean, batteries are dangerous. High capacity batteries in sealed phones are extra dangerous.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to say, and Jerry wrote a good article on this, but it's one thing to say that batteries are dangerous if they come into contact with heat and, you know, anything that has that much energy stored inside of a small space has the potential to blow up. But what this is looking more and more like is a manufacturing defect,
right?
That was at the source, and that's even worse. That's far worse.
If we take Samsung at their word, and at this point, I have no reason not to. They played around a little bit with trying to explain what happened for a bit, but I think that they've finally told us the truth. There's just a mechanical failure in the way they're made.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been caught at the factory. You would think somebody would have taken a sample off the line and looked at it.
Well, let's just hope it never happens again.
Oh, certainly. And I feel bad for the people who worked on the assembly line the days that those batteries were made.
Because they know.
Well,
I mean, Samsung now knows who made which battery and put it in which phone based on the serial numbers.
And I'm going to go through life ignoring what Bloomberg wrote and really, really hope that Samsung didn't know ahead of time that most of the batteries in all of the phones were potentially bombs.
Well, here's the thing. The only thing I can say about that is there are always quality control thresholds where they say, you know, it can be 99.999%, but when it comes to processors, storage, screens, tolerances on the bend of the metal in the frame, there are quality control standards, and those standards are never 100%, nor can you expect them to be. The hope would be that they didn't know that there were, you know, catastrophic issues in any
and
percentage.
That's what I'm going to go with. I mean, there's probably some sort of truth to what's going around now, but I'm going to hope that it's not that damning story
I think that the lawyers at Samsung are hoping that as well.
So I think we've summed it up pretty nicely. You'll be receiving either a new Note 7 with the software update pre-installed, or if you get a new one, it'll be there when you turn it on for the first time. Let us know how your new Note 7 is. Let us know if this is going to affect how you perceive Samsung. podcast@androidcentral.com. But I think it's time to move on to something a little bit more current, and that is the Sony Xperia X Compact. This is a
phone.
Didn't
explode.
No explosions that we know of. Sony has, I think, and Andrew will probably verify this, released its best phone of the year so far. Is that reasonable to say, Andrew?
Well, obviously it's not the best in that, like, it's the top of the line. It's the best in that it's, you know, we just got pricing on the Xperia XZ, which is the second half of 2016 flagship, and it's $700 in the US, which is a really hard price to justify for the Xperia XZ.
As somebody who uses a lot of Sony products, and I don't know why, my open source nerdy friends rail on me constantly. Did you expect anything else?
No, I did not at all.
This is Sony. You pay for that name, whether it's a good name or bad. That's what you're paying for.
Yeah, I don't expect any less, to be honest. But I'm saying, so that's a known thing. The Xperia XZ is $700 in the US, doesn't have a fingerprint sensor. What the hell? But the X Compact at $500, I think, like Daniel said, it is a better more interesting phone than the XZ is at $700, and mostly because the X Compact kind of stands in its own little segment where you're not trying to pay, you're not paying top dollar for top everything, which Sony can kind of, you know, and has proven to lose out on a lot of the market compared to the way that other manufacturers are selling their phones at a way faster rate. But the X Compact is this interesting little phone because at 4.6 inches, it's easily the nicest small phone you can buy right now. And if you're somebody who wants the small phone, and there's something, you know, I wrote in the conclusion of my review that there's, I went into it like liking the nostalgia of having a powerful small phone that I can just, you know, it's small in my pocket, it's small in my hand, you don't have to think about it, it's not trying to be a gigantic supercomputer. And then by the end of using it, I was legitimately happy to use it. Not because it's small or anything like that, but because it's just a really good phone, because it has a great screen. I don't really care that it's plastic because it's built super well in typical Sony fashion, and it at the same time has a very standout design that you immediately can tell is Sony. And you set it next to any other phone available today, it looks different, which is cool. And it has stereo speakers and USB-C with fast charging and amazing battery life. And the performance is really, really good. And the camera is probably the best that Sony's ever put in a phone, which is the same as the Xperia XZ. And of course it's overpriced because it's a Sony phone. It's $500. I think Amazon is dropping $50 off of it if you pre-order, so $450, which is a little more palatable. It's more expensive than an Honor 8 or a OnePlus 3 or a ZTE Axon 7. It's only like $100 less than you could buy an iPhone 6S for. It's only $100 less than a Galaxy S7 unlocked. And so you know you're overpaying for what you're getting, you know, in terms of size and individual components. But it's like, it's easily the best Sony phone that I've used just as a singular device.
Yeah, I mean, what's so interesting is that we only recently got the Xperia X Performance. It was announced. Was it announced at Mobile World Congress, the X and X Performance? So it took a while to come to market. We saw it at Google I.O., again, just before Google I.O., but it took a while for it to filter down to us. And it never quite made sense. It wasn't as big a break as it should have been from the Z line. And it was extremely disappointing, especially the X Performance, which was also $700. And
yes, and I checked now, it's like $575. It's already dropped considerably.
Of course. Don't buy that phone for all...
No, don't.
Just don't. But this phone seems... And the XZ seems really interesting. It's a bit of a break in design. And now some people are saying that we, Android Central, have been incorrectly reporting that they have optical image stabilization. Do you want to clear that up a little? Because I think we're right. It does have OIS.
Yeah, I've been battling, well, I've been having delightful conversations with people about this topic. Because we actually, when we were at IFA, we got to sit down with a couple of people from Sony and talk to them about it, because they're pretty happy about this. And I think that where the break is coming here is the difference between Sony's marketing and willingness, over willingness to put a brand and spin on every single little feature, like when they have their, you know, Sony Bravia engine with X Reality for mobile triluminous display and all this kind of stuff. So that's at play here for sure. So the camera, here's the thing. I don't know the specifics. I have not opened the phone and looked at it, but based on what I know and what I've been told and what I can tell from using the phone, it looks like it has traditional three-axis OIS, like most other modern phones do, and that the camera is physically stabilized. And then Sony, like a lot of other manufacturers, does electronic image stabilization as well. And this is primarily for the video camera. So if you're shooting in 1080p, it can do electronic image stabilization as well. And this is something that they borrowed from their camcorder business. I think it's called SteadyShot or something like that. Stupid brand. And that helps them stabilize what's coming out of the video camera even more, because they can tell the position of objects and they can stabilize it within the frame, because the camera sensor is technically capable of recording larger video than 1080p. So that's why we see all these warnings or disclaimers and things in the product page where Sony says, five-axis image stabilization only available in 1080p and only available in this shooting mode and whatever. That doesn't mean that the OIS, you know, is not OIS. It just means that the additional steady shot five-axis software layer is not enabled in certain modes of the camera. Now, you can't simulate five-axis image stabilization in software. That's just not how that works. There has to be a hardware component to that. And my experience in using the camera as well shows that there has to be stabilization in there, just from a standpoint of how long it can leave the shutter open and how good the low light photos are compared to any previous Sony camera that uses the exact same camera sensor.
Right. And what's so interesting about Sony is that it makes, or a subsidiary of Sony makes, the sensors not only for its phones, but many other phones, including the Galaxy S7 and the iPhone 7, we think. And yet the Sony experience has never quite been as good, even though it gives itself sensors that are larger than on any other phone. It's a 1/2-inch sensor. It's got great fidelity. It has decent IQ. But somehow the photos themselves just never quite look as good. I mean, it baffles the mind.
And this new setup with the X Compact and the XZ still is not as good as the Galaxy S7. I think it is more on par with like what the Honor 8 does, except for in low light where it's ahead, because Honor 8 lacks OIS. It's very similar to the OnePlus 3 in terms of quality. And that is still the weird thing to me. This steady shot software stuff apparently is exclusive to Sony's own phones right now. This is like the first time that they've done something that's legitimately exclusive to their phones without opening it to partners, which is cool. But it's not like such a massive departure that you're like, holy cow, Samsung is like in the dust. No, this is still where the Xperia X Compact isn't. You know, it's just a middle of the road camera, you know, for its price. It's above average quality, still not that great. But I mean, just to put a bow on the image stabilization thing, that's what we were told, and what we found when we used it backs that up. And we're also basing this on the Xperia XZ, which I used and Alex used and reviewed as well, has the same exact camera setup. So There is that as well, but that's, to bring it all back, that camera experience that's good, but a couple steps away from being great, is the reason why it's okay in the X Compact at $500. It is not really okay in the $700 XZ. So that's where it all comes together, is that the X Compact, you're paying a little bit of Sony tax, but legitimately it's a great phone, you know, on its own in this weird middle ground at this price, in a way that the XZ can't attain, and the X Performance definitely was not, and it stands separately from the XA and XA Ultra and all those lower end phones.
Still so weird. Sony still baffles my mind. So before we end today, I wanted to chat a little bit with Jerry about Bluetooth headphones specifically. They're becoming a lot more mainstream, I guess, not only because they're getting cheaper and better, but also in recent weeks because of the iPhone 7 announcement, not having headphone and not having a headphone jack. But this isn't the first phone to ship without a headphone jack. The Moto Z did so, and the Moto Z Force did it in July. And it just may be a good idea for you to invest in Bluetooth headphones. So without actually recommending any, we can if you want. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about them because, like, where are they in terms of quality and comfort and price compared to a good pair of wired headphones today, Jerry?
Well, I mean, Bluetooth audio with the right, let's say your Galaxy S7 is a great example, or your iPhone that has the right codec support. And if you get a good pair of Bluetooth headphones, and it's going to cost you $100 or more, that also has support for the right codecs, it sounds good. You know, I like good audio, and I can't say it sounds bad. It doesn't take you over the edge if you want to sit down and listen to something at low volume, nice and quiet, and just feel that little bit. And Dan, I know you know what I'm talking about. You get a little bit more immersion from very high bit rate, high depth audio. Bluetooth can't give us that yet. But for everyday listening, you know, if you're, you know, working and listening to a podcast or, you know, streaming music, they sound great.
Okay, so the average person who just wants to stream Spotify probably won't know the difference between a $100 pair of over-the-ear wired headphones and wireless. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. Well, if you're streaming anything, you really won't see a difference. Even playing local music from your phone, most people won't, if they hear a difference, it won't be enough for them to care.
Right. And that's important. I think that's important to know because Bluetooth still has a bit of a stigma around sound quality. And there's one technology developed by Qualcomm. It's actually not developed by Qualcomm. It's developed by a company that Qualcomm purchased.
Yeah.
And it's called aptX. And you see it a little bit, but it's not as prolific as I think it should be. Can you explain a little bit about aptX and why you want a pair of headphones that support it?
Because Bluetooth, the data transfer speeds aren't very fast. 15 years ago, they were blazing fast, but they haven't gotten any faster. So you can't send huge chunks of data reliably. So you have to break your data into smaller chunks. And then what aptX does for audio data, it compresses it even further. It can be 4-to-1 or even up to 8-to-1. That means it can send it faster, and the receiving item, whether it be a speaker or a set of headphones, supports aptX and can decode that, so there's no buffering. And when I say buffering, not the buffering that you're used to while you're waiting for a video to load or a song to stop being paused, tiny minute buffers that will affect the sound quality, not the duration. aptX does away with a lot of that. And it's gotten a lot better since it was initially released. Now they've got what's called aptX Enhanced, and I've listened to aptX Enhanced from a home receiver unit that had it and a good pair of Bluetooth, you know, a good headset. I can't say it sounds any better or any worse than most of the music I listen to with wired headphones, which is saying a lot because I'm very picky.
So is it worth waiting? Is it worth waiting for a pair to support?
You know what? For you and I, or people like us, that
you mean music snobs? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'll say it. We'll appreciate the difference, but is it worth waiting? No, because how much money have you thrown away on headphones, Dan? Let's not even go there, huh?
The first pair of $600 headphones I bought was back in 2004. So let's say a lot of money.
Yeah. So no, don't bother waiting because an even better technology will be coming out in the middle of next year called aptX Lossless, which promises to deliver 96 kilobits per second, 32-bit audio.
So talk to me about this, Jerry, because I'm glad that you've laid it out there that depending on the music source, but for most people, you won't tell a difference in quality because I don't really care all that much. When I'm walking down the street or going and waiting for a bus or a train or riding my skateboard around, I don't care. Like, I'm not going to notice a difference in audio quality anyway in my headphones.
Right.
With all the extra noise, I'm not wearing noise canceling headphones, all that kind of stuff. What I care about is, of course, not having a cord tangled that'll yank my phone out of my pocket or yank the headphones out of my ears when it gets, you know, snagged on something. But so for the big thing for me is I still deal with it depending. It always depends on the weird combination of the headphones and the phone that it cuts out kind of randomly. You know, of course, like if my phone is in my, you know, a deep pocket of my backpack and I have, you know, little active sport headphones that don't have apparently a large antenna or a transceiver in them, and it cuts in and out. Like, that's the most annoying thing for Bluetooth for me. So what is going on there in terms of, like, why does it work great with some pairs of headphones and phones together, but it won't work great with the same headphones with another phone?
It could be the Bluetooth version is a mismatch. That's more important than people think, and that's especially apparent when you start talking to people trying to pair their phones with their car.
Mm-hmm.
And the streaming codecs, and I mean the Bluetooth data transfer streaming. I would be willing to bet that you like your experience with your little earbuds and your Galaxy S7 a whole lot more than you do with your Nexus.
Well, yeah. I mean, it always just seems, I mean, of course, like I've had issues with Samsung to Samsung, but those are few and right. far between compared to my whatever, these JBL headphones with a Sony phone. Like, and the weird thing for me is I can understand that there's a mismatch in things. The problem is you don't know. And right. that's the kind of, like, it lets me fire up any Bluetooth headphones and search for them on my phone, and they connect and they start playing audio, and it sounds fine when I have the phone right in front of me and the headphones are a foot away sitting there. But the difference is when it's deep in my pocket or in a backpack or something and they're cutting out if I turn my head the wrong way. And there was no way for me to troubleshoot that or know ahead of time because they're all billed as Bluetooth headphones.
And that's difficult to overcome. Actually, it sounds like you may have bigger issues if it can cut out by turning your head. You know, sounds like it takes a lot of battery power, relatively a lot.
Sounds like you may have cement in your brain.
Yeah,
that's really my issue. But so the biggest time that I notice things like that is with like little tiny sport headphones that were obviously designed to have, you know, a phone in an armband strap right at the top of your arm and right there. But we always go to this thought that, hey, it's Bluetooth, it works. If it's within 15, 20, 25 feet, it'll be fine. But that's just not the case, especially if I have my phone, you know, in my pocket pressed up against my leg that's, you know, blocking some of the signal as well.
Right. It's the equipment you buy makes a big difference there.
Well,
you know, you.
So is there any way to tell ahead of time? Like, do you really have to do a lot of extra work here rather than saying, oh, those look cool, buy them?
No, I mean, what I would recommend is if you don't know what kind of phone you have or you're going to buy a new one, don't know what you're going to use, and you want a small set of headphones that you can use while you're working out or while you're running, don't get earbuds. Get a pair that has a band that go around your neck because the battery's bigger. They'll transmit and receive better because they have more power.
Right.
Bluetooth earbuds are really convenient for a lot of people, and a lot of people use them without any issues. But an equal number of people who stick their phone in their purse or in their hip pocket or, like you said, in a backpack, they don't like the experience as much. And that's
right.
A lot of that is to do with the size.
Yeah, I figured. I think that part of it is more annoying to people. It's definitely more annoying to me than any concerns over sound quality. If I'm completely happy with the sound quality, of course, there's big differences in just the quality of the hardware components in the headphones too, that can change quality. Of course, there's fit and all those things. Those things are far less of an issue to me than, you know, I want to be able to wear Bluetooth headphones for 2 hours straight and not have them randomly cut out. And I think that a lot of people still have that issue.
Well, and it's when these products are developed, and I mean the underlying technology, you have extremes at either end that aren't going to perform like designed. If you had a regular pair of on-ear headphones and you were sitting, you know, 6-8 feet away from a device that was sending out Bluetooth audio, and they both used aptX and they were both Bluetooth 4.2, the experience would probably be great. And yeah, that's what it was designed for. And as you move away and get further into the extremes of size or battery capacity or, you know, distance from the object that's transmitting, that affects that. And unfortunately, there's no way to tell. There's nothing I can do and say, Andrew, if you buy these headphones, it will work great with your phone while you're running, because that's just not a given. I mean, the best advice I can give you is buy ones that'll have the biggest battery possible. Not only will you get better battery life, but they'll be able to transmit and receive at full power for longer.
Right.
So bottom line, most of the time, Bluetooth headphones are going to give you as good or better an experience as wired. And the occasions that they don't, you sort of just deal with it, because the benefits of not having a wire kind of outweigh it in many cases. And with a device like with a pair like the Icon X from Samsung, you can even store your own music on it. And Andrew's had his fair share of issues, as have I, with that functionality, because you basically need a PC to do some of these things, which is insane.
I would recommend away from those kind of things.
Yeah.
If you just want to hear some songs, music with your phone, you don't need that.
No. But there are these sort of intelligent, what they're sometimes referred to as hearables, that have a bunch of technology inside them. You know, we may not want to mention them on the show, but the Apple AirPods are an example of that, where they have a bunch of stuff in it that lives on top of the Bluetooth protocol that's supposed to make it a little bit more reliable. And we may see a few more of those types of headphones come to Android. But what's interesting to me is that as Bluetooth headphones become more popular, the concern is that the technology is not going to be able to keep up. So, you know, we're still a couple years away from Bluetooth 5.0, and that could be the turning point for the reliability and the bandwidth. But until then, you're kind of dealing with these, I hate to say it, but hacks in a way to get them to work as well as wired headphones.
Mm-hmm.
So never going to work as well as wired headphones, but they will work well enough.
So before we go, headphone recommendations. I know people have asked us a lot about them. Jerry, you recommend the Jabra Move.
I probably didn't say that very well. I recommend those for me. I know the devices that I'm going to be using and their capabilities, and those headphones match up very well with that. You don't know, see, they don't have aptX. So they're fine for me, and I can save that money because the phone I have today and the phone I'm going to be buying in 4 weeks don't have aptX. So
those retail for $100, but it looks like they're steeply discounted at certain places too. And those are on-ear headphones.
Right. I don't do earbuds. They just pop out everywhere.
Right.
And I'm sorry, Dan. I'm interrupted and ruined your whole train of thought.
No. And you know, some people in Mobile Nation, Serenity Caldwell from iMore, she heartily recommends the $399 Bose QC35s. And those are kind of the airplane standards, if you will, but most people don't need headphones that expensive. And I just think if you are moving in the direction of Bluetooth headphones, Jerry makes a good point. in his article, go to a store and try as many of them as you can within reason and test it out, because headphones, Bluetooth headphones, are like any headphones. They are, everyone is different, and one is not going to be the right one for you. The one that's right for you may not be the right one for your friend or family. So take some time to try them out.
Yep. Even if you can't get an exact feel for how they're going to sound with all your music, you'll know how they fit. And equally as important, some headphones just suck. Dan, you know this. Some of them look beautiful and they're expensive and they've got a lot of great features, but when you listen to them, they just suck. You'll know that right away.
100%. All right, well, I think we're going to leave it there. Before the show, we talked about getting it under an hour, so we're about 40% over that. If people want to find you on the internet, Jerry, where can they go?
The best way to get a hold of me, I guess, on the internet would be at GB Hill on Twitter, GBHIL.
And it makes me happy that you're embracing that.
Well, I have no choice. No, I'm just kidding.
It's in your contract.
Yeah, basically it is. Damn it. But and I do try, guys. I don't answer. I suck at it, but I'm trying.
He's trying, and we appreciate that.
Now, if you still use email, jerry@androidcentral.com, I get back to everybody. It may take me a while because I got quite a few backed up, but that's the ultimate best way because that's just how I do it.
And Andrew, where can people find you if they want to get a hold of you?
Also on Twitter, but I like to think that I'm pretty responsive, at Andrew Martinik, MARTONIK. But you can find that spelling on Android Central as well.
Yes, you can. And along with Andrew's excellent Xperia X Compact review. My name is Daniel Bader. You can find me on Twitter at JourneyDan. You can find all of us at Android Central. And if you haven't followed us yet on Instagram, we post some really great stuff there to both Instagram, the feed, and to our daily stories update. So check that out as well. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Adios.